Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Today on the program, we hear about what the United Nations has called the biggest humanitarian crisis in the world, the situation in Iraq and Syria. The UN says more aid is needed to feed and clothe refugees. But first, we tell about a new report about hunger. It says empowering women can help fight hunger and find answers to other problems. A report on world hunger and the crisis in Syria and Iraq are next on As It Is. A Christian aid group says problems like hunger, malnutrition, and poverty cannot be solved until and unless women are treated as well as men. The group Bread for the World released a report on hunger this week. It says the number and percentage of hungry people worldwide is dropping. But it says the drop could be greater if governments and societies worked to make sure women had rights and power equal to those that men have. VOA's Christopher Cruz spoke to members of the group this week at an event held to mark the report's release.
Fauzia Dashir of Kenya created the Northern Organization of Social Empowerment. She works with women farmers, showing them how to earn money by growing cash crops. She told VOA that women should not hope that men will give them power. They should take it.
Women should not wait for men. Women should not even wait for any institution. It's about them. They should wake up. They should get out of their comfort zone, work together, and do so much, you know, for themselves.
Gary Barker leads a non-governmental organization that seeks to involve men in fighting for the equal treatment of women and ending violence against women. Mr. Barker says improving the lives of women will not hurt men. In fact, he says, just the opposite will happen.
We use an expression off at the community level that men of quality are not afraid of equality. It is really about changing what our relations as men and women are, and we should be happy and celebrate that as men, not be afraid of it.
Gary Barker notes that many men use violence against women, but he says the majority of men do not. He says they should work to keep other men and boys from attacking women. Asma Latif works for Bread for the World. She says just 10% of agricultural development aid goes to women, yet 43% of all farmers are women. Ms. Latif says governments should help with child care and require equal pay for equal work. She says employers should pay women when they are sick and not take money from their wages when they are unable to work for a short time.
There are so many things that women do, the unpaid care work, the household chores, that are really not factored into programs. So women are, in the end, doing twice as much work.
Bread for the World says men should help women with household duties, sharing some of the heavy burden women now carry, mostly on their own. Mr. Barker says if men did more housework and caregiving, and women had more power, men and their families would be helped.
Women's income coming into the household is good for us as men, too. It frees the pressure on our backs to be sole providers. And I think we show the economic data that would say the U.S. GDP would grow by 9% if women were in the paid workforce as much as men are.
Bread for the World says girls should be permitted to attend school for as long as boys do. It notes studies show that when girls in Africa are able to complete their schooling, their families are less likely to live in poverty. Worldwide, 800 women die giving birth every day, and 39,000 young girls are married to older men each day. That is 14 million every year, or 1 in 9 girls. The group says 3/4 of girls in Niger, 2/3 of girls in Bangladesh, and 1/2 of the girls in India become what are known as child brides. Bread for the World has been releasing reports on poverty and hunger for 20 years. The group plans to give its report to all 535 members of the United States Congress. This is the first time it has used one of its reports to strongly call for equal treatment of men and women. I'm Christopher Cruz.
You are listening to the VOA Learning English program as it is. The United Nations says Iraq and Syria need more aid to deal with the humanitarian crisis in those countries. The situation is expected to worsen with the arrival of winter. Bob Doty has this report.
Millions of people in Syria and Iraq need humanitarian aid. Many of these men, women, and children fled violence with only the clothes they were wearing. The United Nations is calling the situation in Syria and Iraq the biggest humanitarian crisis in the world today. Baroness Emma Nicholson is with the Amar International Charitable Foundation. She says donors are not reacting to appeals for more donations.
For a reason I cannot understand, I cannot explain, the world has barely shifted in its response. The big funders haven't come across, yet there are 1.4 million new refugees, IDPs, inside Iraq alone, and you know what's going on in Syria, and this is spreading.
Joel Charney is with InterAction, an alliance of more than 180 non-governmental organizations.
I think part of it is that there are so many emergencies right now.
He adds that donors may be facing difficult decisions about where to send their money.
So some of it is competition or sort of donors trying to figure out, do we respond in Syria and Iraq? Do we respond in South Sudan? Do we respond in the Central African Republic? We now have the Ebola crisis.
Some countries have donated large amounts. Since 2012, the United States has provided more than $1.5 billion to help Iraqis and Syrians. Saudi Arabia recently gave the United Nations $500 million. But Joel Charney says more than just money is needed to ease the crisis.
Yes, if we had more aid, we could provide more services. But, I mean, let's face it, fundamentally, this is a crisis that can only be solved diplomatically. And the whole diplomatic process has ground to a halt.
As winter starts to arrive, humanitarian groups are exploring ways to raise interest in the general public so people will donate more. But the groups say they have not yet succeeded. I'm Bob Doty.
Today, is the Thanksgiving holiday in the United States. So on this day, we at VOA Learning English give thanks for all the good people and things in our lives. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is from VOA Learning English.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
This is the VOA Learning English Education Report. More than 500,000 South Korean students in their final year of high school recently took the university entrance examination. Many people consider success on this test the first step toward a good life. But South Korean students say they feel stressed from the pressure. 17-year-old student Lee Ji-woo is not ready yet to take the test, but he has a strong opinion about it. He says, "This test can determine the rest of your life." South Korean high school students spend years studying for the university entrance examination. People say good scores guarantee entrance to a top university and the possibility of a high-paying job. Some say good test results even improve chances for a good marriage in the future. The test is multiple choice, meaning that the student may choose among several possible answers to a question. Some observers say this system does not help the students learn to think for themselves. They also say South Korea is not the only country to use these tests. Jasper Kim is a professor at Seoul's Ewha Women's University.
I think you'll see similar things in China and to a lesser degree in Japan. It became the end-all be-all, the standardized tests, what you got on it. So what that created was a system of teaching to the test. So everyone was geared in terms of getting to the right answer and not knowing why that is the right answer.
Vietnam also is known for its university entrance examination. Professor Kim says this system of learning by memorization produces a lot of stressed students. A recent government study found that South Korean children are the least happy compared to children in 29 other developed countries. Many South Koreans blame educational pressure for this unhappiness. South Korean President Park Geun-hye has promised to reform her country's educational system. She urges the system to increase creative thinking and reduce student tension. But Jasper Kim does not feel sure that reforms by the top government alone will solve the problem.
The bureaucrats, they can say whatever they want, but really it starts at home.
Still, getting South Korean parents to ease the pressure on their children might not be so easy. Shin Jung-young says she would like not to put so much pressure on her daughter. But she says there is a lot of competition, so it is impossible for parents not to do so. For now, all Ms. Shin and other parents can do is hope that the pressure brings good results. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report for today. I'm Jerry Watson.
Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the early weeks of 1863, the American Civil War took a new political direction. President Abraham Lincoln had announced the Emancipation Proclamation. That measure freed the slaves in the rebel states of the South, though Lincoln's words fell on deaf ears. Yet no longer was the Civil War a struggle just to save the Union. It had become a struggle for human freedom. There was a change on the military side of the war, too. President Lincoln named a new commander for the Union's Army of the Potomac. This was the force that would try again to capture the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant describe events during the spring of 1863.
General Joe Hooker was the new commander of the Army of the Potomac. He replaced General Ambrose Burnside when Burnside suffered a terrible defeat at Fredericksburg, Virginia, at the end of 1862. Burnside had replaced General George McClellan when McClellan kept refusing to obey President Lincoln's orders. Hooker had 130,000 men. They were well trained and well supplied. The Confederate force opposing Hooker's was under the command of General Robert E. Lee. Lee had only about 60,000 men. They did not have good equipment, and their supplies were low. But their fighting spirit was high. They had defeated the Union Army before. They were sure they could do it again.
Lee's army still held strong defensive positions along high ground south of Fredericksburg. This was almost halfway between the capitals of the opposing sides, Washington and Richmond. General Hooker did not plan to make the same mistake which General Burnside made at Fredericksburg. Burnside had thrown his army against Lee's defensive positions 6 times. Each time, the Confederates pushed them back easily. In one day of fighting, more than 12,000 Union soldiers were killed or wounded. General Hooker had rebuilt the Army of the Potomac. Now, he was ready to carry out his plan against General Lee. Hooker left half his men at Fredericksburg in front of Lee's army. He would move the other half into position behind Lee's army. If Lee turned to meet him, the troops at Fredericksburg would attack. The Confederate army would be caught between two powerful forces. Lee would have to withdraw or lose his army.
Hooker moved around past the end of Lee's line. Then he turned and started marching back behind it. It was a hard march through thick woods and across rough hills and valleys. The country was so wild that it was called the Wilderness. On the last day of April 1863, the Union force reached Chancellorsville. Chancellorsville was a crossroads near the edge of the Wilderness. The next day, the soldiers would be in open country. There, General Hooker could make the best use of his men. Hooker was extremely pleased. Everything was going as he had planned. He told his officers, "I have Lee in one hand and Richmond in the other." The next day, Union soldiers began moving out of Chancellorsville and the Wilderness. They did not get far. They ran into several thousand Confederate soldiers. Lee had sent them to slow the Union force.
The Confederate force was weak. General Hooker's officers believed they could smash through it without difficulty. They did not get a chance to try. Hooker sent new orders: break off the fight, return to Chancellorsville, put up defensive positions. Hooker's officers were shocked. They protested. Hooker stood firm. He said, "Lee must fight me on my own ground." Robert E. Lee could not understand why the Union force had returned to Chancellorsville, but he was happy it did. Now he had time to prepare his men for battle.
Lee met that night with his top general, Stonewall Jackson. They discussed the best way to attack the Union force. The center of the Union line was strong. The right side was not. Jackson was sure he could get around behind it. Lee asked Jackson how many men he would take. "All of them," Jackson answered, 28,000. This meant Lee would have only 14,000 men to face General Hooker. If the Union force attacked before Stonewall Jackson got into position, Lee could not possibly hold it back. Lee was taking a huge chance. He thought about it for a moment. Then he told Jackson to get started.
Jackson's men began to leave the next morning. Union soldiers watched as they marched away. General Hooker thought Lee was withdrawing. It took Jackson only half a day to get behind the Union force. He spent a few more hours putting his troops into position. Then he attacked. It was 6 o'clock in the evening. The right end of the Union force was not prepared for an attack. The soldiers could not believe their eyes when they saw Confederate troops running out of the woods behind them. Many Union soldiers were killed or wounded. Thousands fled. The sun went down. The fighting continued under a bright moon. The Confederate troops kept moving forward. The Union troops kept falling back. One Northern soldier wrote later, "Darkness was upon us. Jackson was upon us. And fear was upon us."
Jackson seemed to be everywhere. He rode his horse among his men, urging them forward. He would not let the Union force escape. As Jackson and some of his officers rode into a cleared area of the woods, shots rang out. The bullets came from Confederate guns. The Confederate soldiers thought they were firing on Union officers. Jackson fell from his horse. Two bullets had smashed his left arm. Another bullet had hit his right hand. He was hurried to the back of the line. A doctor quickly cut off his left arm and stopped the heavy bleeding. Jackson seemed to get better. Then he developed pneumonia. He was unconscious most of the time. He seemed to dream of battle and shouted commands to his officers. Then he grew quiet. He opened his eyes and said, "Let us pass over the river and rest in the shade of the trees." The great Confederate general Stonewall Jackson was dead.
While Jackson lay dying, the Battle of Chancellorsville continued. Robert E. Lee's Confederate army was much smaller than Joe Hooker's Union army. But for 5 days, Lee kept part of his army moving between Chancellorsville and Fredericksburg. Wherever the Union army attacked, Lee quickly added more men to his lines. The Union army could not break through. The fighting was taking place on the south side of the Rappahannock River. The Union army's supply lines were on the north side. Spring rains were beginning to make the Rappahannock rise. General Hooker did not want to get trapped without food and ammunition, so he ordered his men back across the river.
The South had won the Battle of Chancellorsville. Robert E. Lee was sure of that. Once again, he had forced back the Army of the Potomac. But the Union Army was not hurt seriously. New soldiers would soon take the place of those lost in battle. Lee, however, would find it more difficult to replace his soldiers. The South was running out of manpower. Every Confederate army needed men, more and more men. Yet fewer and fewer Southern boys were willing to become soldiers. Anti-war movements were, in fact, active in both the North and South. There were a number of protests against the military draft. Some turned violent. In the North, a political party was created to oppose the Civil War. Leaders of this peace party were called Copperheads. They got the name because they wore a copper penny showing the head of an Indian. That will be our story in our next program on the Civil War.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant. Our series can be found online with transcripts, podcasts, and historical images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow our weekly programs on Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.